Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Super Bowl 46 was not only the highest rated television event in history, it was also the largest social media event for television with some 5.4 million commentators, I put that in quotation marks, posting some 12.2 million comments, according to Bluefin Labs. Today on Tech Tuesday, how was social media used during the Super Bowl and why did it set new records with advertisers embracing social media in new ways? Joining us now to talk about all of that is our regular digital media consultant, Deborah Jasper, co-founder of Mindset Digital. Welcome back, Deborah.
Hi, Ann. Great to be here.
And also joining us again is Rob Evans. He's an analyst for Mindset Digital. Welcome back, Rob.
Hi, Ann. Nice to be here.
For our listeners, how did you use social media during the Super Bowl this year, or did you not know what the heck they were talking about? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, social media, the commercials, it was just rampant now.
It's true. And I mean, you really start to watch the Super Bowl and you realize it's not just about putting up an ad anymore. You know, this is for advertisers, the game has really changed, so to speak, because they're doing things like announcing hashtags, which is a search term on Twitter. And so you're seeing really fun hashtags. They are trying to drive people to special sites where you can, you know, download apps and play games and it's just a very, very different world. People are starting to realize this can't just be about me showing you the ad. It's about me engaging you in the ad and getting you to talk back and hearing what you actually think.
And so, you've talked about that before, though. You've been actually talking about that for years now.
Yeah.
Now they've just taken it to a whole new level, though.
They really have. You're seeing hashtags in almost every ad that the Super Bowl was showing. Although Rob and I were talking, we were saying, boy, if you don't know what that is, today, yeah, you might really feel a little bit out of it.
Right. As I said, or either you noticed it and were enjoying it or at least knew what it was, or you were wondering.
Yeah,
it caught your eye thinking, what don't
this?
I know?
Yeah, so there are some of my favorite ones. One of my favorite hashtags this time was Mary Bacon. Okay, I do really
in the
like
Jack
bacon,
in the Box.
I admit it. And Jack in the Box.
Bacon goes.
But you
makes
take a look
better
at just what they did alone and you realize, wow, new sort of campaign. Because not only are they doing the ads, but at the end they're trying to drive you to Twitter. Then you can go to their microsite or a small website that's just devoted to this sort of ad campaign, and you can buy Valentine's cards that say, I love you more than bacon. I mean, they have or you can upload pictures and see what your offspring would be like had you married bacon. So they're doing all this really funny stuff, but the ad is just the beginning. And that's the new thing.
And not only are you expected to sort of have a great hashtag and a great campaign and a great commercial, but then, you know, every piece of your content has to be funny and shareable and sort of appealing to such a wide demographic. It's a really high bar.
And one of the things about the Super Bowl is you are pulling in an incredible array of demographics there. It's not just, Top Chef, someone who's into cooking or, pick your, American Idol or something like that. It's like the whole gamut.
I know. And it's really funny. This shows up on Twitter a lot. So 58% of women admit to watching the Super Bowl for just the commercials.
Admit.
I am one of those women. Okay, I sort of got into the Super Bowl this year because it was really good.
I don't
good,
do it for the Super Bowl halftime show anymore, that's
I'm not
for sure.
So much, But anyway, so we're really into watching the commercials. And of course, we were tweeting the most about the David Beckham ad. Women were really tweeting a lot about that ad. It was all very sexy and it was David Beckham and his underwear.
Illustrated man.
Exactly. Yeah. And then men, what were they tweeting the most about? They were tweeting the most about the Detroit ad. So
with Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood, right.
And so you can even see playing out on Twitter sort of how the gender divide, which ads are most popular. And you want to talk a little bit about some of the numbers?
Sure. So we were looking at which ads particularly used online. We saw only 32% of ads had no sort of online content.
Hmm. Well, that's a third still.
Yeah, that surprises me.
Mm-hmm. 60% had some kind of website. And of those, we saw 8 in particular that had some kind of either a Facebook icon or a Twitter hashtag, one of those little items like that.
Yeah, there were a total of 15.8 million tweets. Compare that to the State of the Union, Anne, 800,000 tweets.
Only 800,000. Yeah. There must have been more last year, though, for some reason, I think.
No, you mean really? No, it's up 500% from last year. The tweets for the Super Bowl.
Super Bowl, okay.
Oh, maybe for the State of the Union last year.
I don't know why.
There were an average of 10,000 tweets per second during the last 3 minutes of the game with the hashtag Super Bowl. And Madonna's performance had about 8,000 tweets per second. So on average, Twitter usually is around 3,000 tweets per second. So you think about, I mean, traffic was way up and lots of folks were talking about the game and the ads and the halftime show and all of that.
And those two records then displaced, in order, Tim Tebow's overtime game-winning pass and Beyonce's pregnancy announcement. So now you've got an idea of the top five.
Google Plus, how did it fare?
And you know, we didn't see Google Plus mentioned in any of the ads, which is interesting. I mean, but you look at this, they're calling this the social media event, the social media Super Bowl, because really the amount of people talking about this online, you're really starting to see us move from a one way where it used to be we all sat around, maybe with a crowd, but we all sat around and watched. And now we're all engaging and commenting and challenging and retweeting. And, you know, it's just a very different experience. Twitter and I think Facebook have really changed the experience of watching the game. Even if you're home alone, you can watch the game with all your friends. You know, that
and
sort
with,
of thing.
You know, 800,000 or a million other people.
And I do think that, you know, sort of looking at the demographics of the Super Bowl and the demographics right now, even Google Plus's strongest advocates, I think, would admit that it's more of a younger, tech-savvy. Whereas, you know, the Super Bowl audience, you're looking at such a wide, as we talked about, wide and diverse.
But this is so much bigger than compared to, like, Steve Jobs' death. You were looking at about 6,000 tweets.
Well, I mean, you think about how far they've come, though.
Right. And the numbers are way up.
It's the Super Bowl. I mean, it's the biggest television event. But, again, it's that broad range of people. It's a lot of older people.
Yeah. But also the numbers of people on Twitter are just way up. 250 million tweets.
Per day.
You know, I mean, that's part of what's happening. We're all just engaging more, and we're all getting more used to commenting at a hashtag and, you know, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And now, here's what's funny for advertisers. Ads are also being judged on which ad was the most commented on. So the most commented on ad of the Super Bowl was David Beckham. Second was It's Halftime in America. But then Betty White was very popular, and Doritos, Man's Best Friend, you know?
And that one
a really
pulled
funny
in
ad.
With the most positive comments. So
people just enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the dog paying off the guy.
Yeah, where the dog is saying, the cat's missing. Someone was commenting on YouTube. I was just laughing. You know, cats have no respect in the Super Bowl ads. It's all about the dogs. Dogs can get your beer. Dogs can get your Doritos.
Right.
Cats, on the other hand, not so popular in the Super Bowl campaign. I just think that's really funny.
614-292-8513. We still have a few minutes left with our guest, Rob Evans. He's an analyst for Mindset Digital, and also Deborah Jasper, social media consultant and co-founder of Mindset Digital. We're talking about Super Bowl. Is there anything you wanted to talk about in terms of Super Bowl and social media? Did you have a favorite ad? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page if you're feeling particularly social media-ish. Super Bowl promotion gone wrong. Toyota is dealing with some backlash. What happened there?
So, you know, they were looking for people, you know, the millions of people tweeting at the hashtags related to the Super Bowl, right? And so they'd see somebody put a post up that was linked, identified itself as about the Super Bowl, and without any other sort of invitation, they would send what's sort of a personal message to that person on Twitter, which is also a tactic that almost every spam account on Twitter uses. And in fact, that runs them afoul of Twitter's own guidelines about what's an acceptable sort of volume and tactic for accounts. So I think a lot of people were getting sort of bizarre messages from Camry campaign with no real invitation to it.
Well, they were sending them and trying to get them to enter a Camry contest, to win a Camry. So, you know, they were saying, hey, if you enjoyed the Camry Super Bowl ad, enter this contest. And people just don't respond well to that. People didn't like it. It backfired. I mean, it was interesting. Their digital campaign manager was saying, this is going to be, we are really going to do an aggressive rollout. But that's the key. How aggressive? You really have to be thoughtful about how you're using hashtags, particularly if you're at messaging people, which is sort of like sending you a message that says, hey, Ann, if you like the Super Bowl, enter this contest to win a free Camry. A lot of people don't want you to send them those messages.
It's funny about Twitter, isn't it? It's funny about social media. You don't want someone trying to sell you something on it.
You really don't. And it has to be, it's more seen as a relationship building site. And if you start to pitch me, people are just not into getting pitchy messages. It's sort of like you may be able to get away with calling my home if you're a telemarketer, but don't call my cell phone. Definitely don't tweet me. We just don't, we don't want to hear that. And we don't respond well to it. And we have recourse now because we can complain about you on Twitter. So that really changes, that sort of changes the deal. So it was a definitely, I think they learned a lot and they apologized. And actually some of those accounts were suspended and the main Camry Effect account has been changed to a protected account. Hmm. And everybody's sort of starting to say, I would call that hashtag lesson learned.
Yeah, and it's been an interesting week for month for
There's
hashtags,
always a lesson.
Too.
It has, because McDonald's had this issue, too. They used a hashtag, and it went awry, and people were complaining about McDonald's at the hashtag they announced. And again,
what was their hashtag?
It was
hash browns.
Yeah.
I mean, what was it?
So they got away with it for a while. They were just doing a social media campaign about where their food comes from. And I think the they were okay with farm fresh or something like that was the original hashtag. But when they transferred over into McD stories, that was the opening.
People started telling McD stories that were not nearly the kind of McD stories McDonald's was hoping.
Kind of reminds
tell.
Me of the Honda lesson back in the day when they were, was it they're unveiling a new hot, was it, or no, some vehicle came out, they thought it was really hot, they opened, started a Facebook page on
it. Yes, and people hated
that car. Invited criticism
as
well.
And in fact, a blogger, it was like 81% of the people said, set the car on fire in a blog survey. And so, yeah, you really have to be careful. This is not a situation if you're a marketer where you can just build it and they will come and say things that you like. Sometimes you build it, they will come and say things that you don't. And you really have to be thinking about that before you announce that hashtag or before you say, hey, everybody, come and talk about my company or my product or my car or my hamburger. You really have to make sure people are, you know, are they going to say the things that you hope that they
do? Yeah, I think the lesson is it's a really powerful tactic. And just like with any really powerful tactics, you need to do your homework and figure out.
There is the physics of social media.
Right.
You know,
because people are tweeting out things like, hey, does having a verified Twitter account give Toyota the right to spam people? I mean, see, you can tweet that and reach an awful lot of people.
Right.
I mean, today, really, what I find fascinating about social media, it has dramatically changed the power dynamics. Because it used to be, right, that I own the channel. If I was the marketing person, I spent my $3.5 million and I got to deliver my message and there wasn't much you could do about it. Today, if you don't like my message, you have lots of ways to talk about how you don't like my message, and you can reach a ton of people yourself.
Speaking of which, we only have a few seconds left, but a commercial was made for about $20. And as part of a contest, was this Facebook Twitter contest?
No, this was a separate contest.
Okay.
Doritos ran it through their website.
Oh, it was Doritos. Okay.
And yeah, this is actually how that Man's Best Friend ad came to the top.
That came from an outside person.
Yeah, and this guy who did the contest ended up winning $1 million. So.
For what he called $20 in production costs.
Yeah. Very cool.
Very cool.
So see, there's some fun stories in this.
There's some happy stories. Well, thanks for sharing all of your stories today. Rob Evans with Analyst for Mindset Digital.
Thanks, Ann. Been a pleasure.
And also Deborah Jasper. Thanks for joining us again, Deborah.
Thanks, Ann. Always fun.
Deborah Jasper, social media consultant and co-founder of Mindset Digital. Coming up, we're going to talk about spam. You can't talk about too much spam these days. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
The law firm of Bailey Cavalieri supports the quality programming on WOSU Public Media and is proud to support the Columbus Neighborhoods Project. It's the story of determined pioneers, devastating floods, a vision for a state capital, flourishing theaters, churches, and businesses. A look at what life's like today for people moving back downtown and for families who've been in Franklinton for five generations. Learn more when WOSU-TV presents Columbus Neighborhoods Downtown Franklinton, airing Tuesday, February 14th at 8 p.m. only on WOSU-TV.
And this is 89.7 NPR News. Ohio Governor John Kasich will lay out his plans for 2012 as he takes his State of the State address on the road to Steubenville. Listen to live coverage of the speech this afternoon beginning at 1, right here on 89.7 NPR News. Cloudy skies for today, a high right around 40 degrees. Right now it is 34 degrees in downtown Columbus. There's a chance of a little snow tonight and less than half an inch of accumulation, though, a low of 29. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Well, back in the way old days, spam used to be something you consumed. Now it's something you spurn. It used to be that spam was something that clogged our email inboxes, annoying but manageable. But as the web became the digital center of our lives, spammers have taken up new and sometimes dastardly ways to clog up not just our inboxes, but our lives. Joining us again for Tech Tuesday to talk about digital spam, computer security, and what we need to know to protect ourselves is Steve Fox. Steve is the editorial director of PC World in San Francisco, where he oversees editorial content and strategy for PCWorld.com and PC World Magazine. Welcome back, Steve.
Great to be back.
And to our listeners, what form of spam bugs you the most? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Steve Fox, we know about spam from all those emails we used to get that had to do with all kinds of, often drugs. What's the difference between that and what we're dealing with now?
Right. Well, if you take a look at the stats, they'll tell you that spam, as we used to think of it, which is, you know, junk that you got in your email, advertising Viagra and other things, is absolutely declining. It's declining in that venue because, you know, it's harder for these things to get through. Everyone knows about them. We all know about that Nigerian, oil minister who's going to give us the millions of dollars and all of that. So they've been forced to go to some new areas. And, you know, basically, your last guest talking about social media. Social media is absolutely one of the places where a lot of this new spam is showing up. And the other big thing is, of course, where it happens in mobile devices, because everybody's doing things on their mobile devices, whether it's tablets or phones. And, of course, this is a great avenue to be able to push, you know, unwanted marketing messages and some downright nasty stuff that attempts to get, you know, information from you, whether it's your phone number, your credit card, and the like. So you're going to see this, pretty much everywhere. And because we don't have the same defenses that we've developed over the years to spam that we find in our inboxes, people are falling for some of these tricks.
It sounds or feels different when it's coming across Twitter or Facebook.
That's absolutely true. And Facebook is a great source for this. Recently, my son has a Facebook account, which I allowed him to get when he was 13. And I recently saw something. It was an instant message from him that said, "Hey, look at this crazy picture I saw of you tagged," or something along those lines. Now, fortunately, I knew that it really hadn't come from him. Actually, it said, "OMG, look at this crazy picture."
And he would never say that.
He would never say that, right? Because he's 14. He's beyond that at this point.
Right.
But that's a real example. If I had clicked on that link, it would have, basically opened a page. It could well have infected my account. It could have, made attempts to get my password and the like. Now, maybe my Facebook password might not be that important, but a lot of people use their same passwords all over the place, the same ones everywhere. So, someone gets your password, you have some serious troubles there.
When I get anything that seems spammy, I don't open it, I forward it to the IT guy.
Yeah, that's a good approach. I'm sure they just love you, don't they?
Yeah, well, he always responds and says, "Yep." But
yeah, that's a bad one. Well, there's a few things. There are these fake news sites. You've probably seen some of these. If you may see in a story, there'll be comments, and people will talk about, whatever they liked or didn't like in the story. And very often within those comments, you'll see some sort of a comment. My aunt made $83 an hour doing almost no work, and it was really simple. And then there's a URL, and it will be in the middle of all these comments. And you think, well, let's hope you don't think, hey, that sounds like a great deal, because you get it that it's probably unsavory. But a lot of people click on that link, and that will take you to a web page. And here's the crazy thing. There's a relatively new search engine called Bleko, and according to these guys, there are now 1 million new spam pages are created every hour. So these are just made-up sites. You know, they just kind of create them with ridiculous URLs. And so that these links that you might click on will take you to one of these pages. And, you know, if you go in there, there's all kinds of things they could ask for. There's real danger that you get there. And they essentially, these sites will look like actual news sites. A lot of them will say, as seen on Channel 6, this amazing report on, weight loss or whatever it is. And it's built to look like a page. If you click on any of these offers, that's really a problem. You might be asked to fill out forms and the like. So this is a growing trend that we're pretty much seeing everywhere. It's become so commonplace that, people hardly even blink about it. The question here is, how do you tell what's a real page and what's not a real page? Remember, no such thing as a free lunch, right? Mm-hmm. So if it seems to be promising one, probably not going to happen.
Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hey, Ann. Yeah, I've had a work cell phone for, about 5 years. But it just seems like in the last year, all of a sudden, I've been getting text messages from mortgage companies who think I need to refinance my mortgage. And I just don't understand where they're coming from. And I've also seen in my Twitter account spam followers that I have to eventually go through and delete, to make sure that they can't post anything, But I found it very interesting that they are finding new and interesting ways to get to you. And didn't know if your guest had any comments on that.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, you're talking about mobile phones. There's an incredible surge. We've seen some stats recently. Between 2010 and 2011, there was a rise in malware on phones, which we hadn't really seen much before, of about 22%. In particular, if you've got an Android phone, so many people are getting on Android, and malware jumped by almost 3/4, last year. So, you have to think about, Android. It's essentially open. People can see the code, so it's easy to build things that can spread. Some of the ways that people get infected on, say, an Android phone, you can go to, an app store of some sort, and there's a lot of malware, some very nasty stuff that can be lurking in there. Less so on iOS, on the Apple stuff, because Apple does make, an attempt to keep bad stuff out of the App Store, but it even happens there. And then, the caller had mentioned Twitter. One of the things I get on my Twitter account, I'm constantly getting what seem to be direct responses to me, to a tweet. But in fact, they have links, and those links are just for usually some kind of phony marketing thing or surveys. They actually have nothing to do with whatever I've tweeted about.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian. Sure. Every time I get something like that, Steve, I report it. Does mm-hmm. that make any difference?
No.
Okay. I'm just kind of that kind of goody two-shoes type, and I do, but it doesn't matter. Okay.
Well, actually, it may make some difference if you send in and enough people click, that this is spam. There's a higher likelihood that those will be blocked, but in truth, most of those are going to be caught anyway. What happens is, then there's a new one that comes along. So, it's kind of like how you can't block a particular sender of spam back in the, more traditional spam ways. You block a specific a sender. It doesn't matter. That sender only exists for a short period of time. And then, there's a new address because there's, an endless number of addresses. So it's not bad form, but it might make you feel good and maybe even a little noble, but it's unlikely to make a huge amount of difference.
Okay, so there's advertising spam, which that's just, we know, is always going to be with us. But there's also malicious spam. It's just out there to cause trouble.
Yeah, although I would say that there is probably less of the, malicious na-na-na-na-na spam mm-hmm. that just wants to cause pain, and there's more spam that is trying to do something, you know, specific to make money. One of the things that's happened, and it's happened over the last, you know, many years now, is things like spam and malware have gone from initially people trying to, you know, show off or just, you know, do some damage, some basically an anarchic approach, to much of this being run by really organized crime and the like. So really the idea behind most kind of spam is let's get some information from you. You know, we are in the information age, which means that your information is worth a lot of money to other people. So that's why you'll see a lot of forms and the thing and things like that to get information. There's a another Facebook one where you'll notice in your as you're going through your Facebook account, you'll see that somebody one of your friends likes something, you know, it might be a video or something. And if you click on that, it might, and especially if it seems, you know, surprising or unusual, someone would like this. But if you click on it, what may well happen is you'll be taken to a page where you'll be asked to just fill out a short survey before going to the video in question. And this is a particularly insidious approach because it's playing on the trust in your friend's judgment. And actually, they're going to try to get information from you. Now, this is this kind of clickjacking or what's called likejacking. You know, it's probably not real. Your friend probably didn't really like that Justin Bieber video. You know, somehow you now have clicked on this, and now it'll show up after you've clicked. There's a little bit of code in there. It's going to go in and show that you have also liked this video. So that now all of your friends, aside from questioning your taste, will also be clicking on this link and being asked to fill in, you know, short bits of information. Little bits of information can be worth good money to these people. Plus, they're getting into the code itself, and you know, manipulating things, which is somewhat spooky and unsettling. And that'll show up in Facebook for sure.
My guest is Steve Fox. He's editorial director and vice president of PC World. If you have a question or comment for Steve, we're talking about spam. Everybody has it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, and you can tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. Hashtag spam. Okay, so Facebook, we've talked about clickjacking and likejacking. Facebook subscribe feature, though. The Facebook subscribe. That's a little different,
right.
Isn't it?
Yeah. There's a slight difference there. So, you know, you can subscribe or let other people, you know, subscribe to your Facebook stream. And, you know, if that happens, you know, other people are essentially following you, right? You know, but you don't really, you know all the people who are following you in this case. And, you know, some of them, and by the way, this is not just on Facebook. There's, you know, similar things that you would see, you know, on Google+. And so, you know, people can be, you're giving them access by opening this up so people can be sending you comments, some of them really unsavory. Often the we understand that the ratio of legitimate comments to not legitimate comments it's a terrible ratio. So you're really giving people you know, entree into your life and your Facebook stream, and that's kind of a really bad idea in many cases. And a lot of people are actually not doing this now. They've stopped doing the subscribing piece. You know, even though it is a relatively common thing, we actually, in one of the pieces we have, we were writing about someone who's a public figure on Travel Channel. Her name is Nisha Sheetal, and she had gotten all these subscribers just by, you know, opening up and allowing this, but she was getting, she said, creepy messages from strangers. And eventually decided this just is not worth it. So if you feel like you're a public figure and want to open up to have people subscribe, just keep in mind that it may not be what you want.
Well, you got to have standards, I would imagine. I mean, I think it's always a kind of a dead giveaway when you're the third person they wanted to friend. You might be famous, but
yeah, exactly. Well, you know,
and the other two people are public as well.
Right. Well, yeah, there is this. This is, you know, it's really, it's a, this is a question of oversharing, and you know, perhaps it is a symptom of our age, and there's some questions about that. There's another one that that is, I think, not huge yet, but that people are going to need to be thinking about, in particular as we're doing more and more stuff, you know, on our phones. We have, you know, QR codes, and those are those strange looking patterns of dots, and you basically scan them with your phone, and it'll take you to a website. You could buy things with them or whatnot. Now, the codes themselves, you know, you look at this, as I said, it's a what seemingly random series of dots. It makes about as much sense as the old, you know, UPCs, right? You can't really tell what they say. So you could actually have a bit of QR code that was embedded in a message that could take you directly to malware that would infect your phone. This is really, you know, it's hard to know what you're getting. So this is where you get, you know, you're getting messages in with QR codes. You've got to be pretty careful about that. And I haven't seen a ton of this, but we have seen some of it. And it seems like this is such a positive vector, you know, for infection that we're going to see clearly more of this as people experiment with it and, you know, figure out how to make it work. I mean, there are things you can do about it, including not scanning questionable QR codes if you know what they are. There is a program called Google Goggles that lets you scan a QR code first and shows you what the URL and what it goes to. Then you look at the URL, and if it looks dubious, you don't go there. But that's definitely something coming up. And, you know, interesting, nasty, and inventive, because basically the good guys are always figuring out, the bad guys are always figuring out a way to stay a few steps ahead of the good guys. And that's, I suspect, going to continue for quite some time.
I have an email from Wayne about Craigslist, and I'll go to a phone call about Craigslist. Wayne writes, my top issue is when I submit something on Craigslist and get a next day response asking, is it still available from somebody? Then I get excited and respond, only to get a phony sad reply about how the interested party has an emergency and can't pursue it, but they are so glad their work-at-home money generator is working so well for them.
Yeah, that's okay. So that's a classic. It's, you know, basically pretty much an automated response. There are a number of Craigslist scams. The most common one is kind of a so-called advanced fee scam, where if you put something expensive up for sale on Craigslist, you'll get a question from someone, is it still available? And then you'll say yes, and then there's a follow-up question asking some detail to show, you know, serious interest. Now you're engaged in a conversation, and then you find out that the next email that they want it, they absolutely want it. Now they're out of town, and they'll send their shipper to pick it up. And you know, it's an elaborate scam. It's apparently effective. Of course, you will get some sort of a check for it, with some amount extra for you for your trouble for taking it from some distance. And guess what? That check is no good, and the item is gone. So that plus the one that that email describes are both the classic Craigslist scams. You know, the second one is really much easier, where they're just trying to get you to click on their, you know, great new berry weight loss diet or whatever. So, you know, hey, unfortunately it works.
Doug in Dublin, welcome to the show, Doug.
Thanks. I'm wondering that when you place an ad on Craigslist, if you spell out phonetically, I guess, your phone number rather than publish the numerals, is that an effective way to prevent spamming to your phone?
Well, you know, what I would say to begin with is when you do send this to Craigslist, don't put your phone number at all. You know, you have an option there to have the responses go directly to an anonymized box that, you know, only Craigslist knows that information. A lot of people do put the phone number there because they feel it's faster, it's easier, and, you know, I understand that. But in general, you don't want to do that. However, if you do phonetic things as opposed to, you know, the actual spelling out, yes, in general, that can help on stopping at least bots from understanding these things. It's the same reason why you often see something spelled out DOT dot, you know, DOTCOM as opposed to the actual address, because bots, and other automated systems have trouble understanding that as part of an address. So there is something to your strategy, but I would go a lot farther, and I would not put my phone number in there to begin with.
Okay. Steve Fox, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Steve Fox, he's editorial director and vice president of PC World. Coming up, Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the science of yoga. We talk with New York Times science reporter William Broad about his new book, which investigates the risks and rewards of yoga. Using the latest scientific research, Broad explains the benefits of yoga while debunking the myths surrounding it and explaining why certain yoga poses can be quite dangerous. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. And join us tomorrow for All Sides with Ann Fisher at 10 o'clock. We will have analysis of Governor Kasich's State of the State address with a panel of State House reporters. That's All Sides with Ann Fisher tomorrow morning, beginning at 10.
Support for the State House News Bureau stories on 89.7 come from the law firm of Porter, Wright, Morris, and Arthur LLP, helping businesses and individuals solve complex legal problems throughout Ohio, across the country, and around the world. On the web at porterwright.com.
And Ohio Governor John Kasich will lay out his plans for 2012 in a little more than an hour. He takes his State of the State address on the road to Steubenville. Listen to live coverage of the speech and analysis this afternoon beginning at 1, right here on 89.7 NPR News. 34 degrees in downtown Columbus, a high of about 40 degrees today. There's a chance of some snow tonight, less than half an inch of accumulation, a low of 29. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We've all been in that situation when you're on the go and your treasured smartphone or iPad or computer dies at the most inopportune moment. Today on Tech Tuesday, we'll hear about some trend-setting gadgets to keep us charged and connected. Joining us now is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holley. Welcome back, Russell.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
When you were at the International Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last month, you discovered a gadget that may be the solution to our electronics battery worries. It's called the Power Bag. What is it and how does it work?
So the Power Bag company actually works with a couple of different types of bags. And what they've done is they've taken, you know, maybe a backpack or a messenger bag or a briefcase, and they've sewn a battery and a couple of different kinds of power cables into the battery and you know, woven them through the bag so that you can actually take your phone or your tablet and stick it in the bag and plug it in and let it charge, you know, when you're walking around or not using it.
How big is this battery? What are we talking about?
There's three different sizes that they sell depending on which bag you want or if you want to put a bigger battery in the bag that you've chosen. There's they're measured in milliamp hours. There's 3,000, 6,000, and 9,000. And even the smallest one, the 3,000, is right around two full charges for an iPhone or you know, most Android phones.
So the point being, you can go, you know, you don't have to be in your car or near an electric outlet.
Right. You just plug right in. And a lot of these, you know, especially the backpack, they're in pockets that are very easy to get to even when you're on the go. So instead of having it in your pocket, you know, you could just throw it over your shoulder in this bag. And if you have to have it in your hand, there's even a USB port on the bag itself that you can actually hook a normal charging cable up to and, you know, be able to hold it in your hand and still charge the phone.
So can you have more than one device plugged in at the same time?
There are three cords that are sewn in plus the USB port, and I've used all four at the same time, and it's charged all four of them.
How does it know how to divvy up the power? How does that work?
It does a really good job. It's got a device inside that holds the battery that does a lot of the control for delivering the power, delivering the correct amount of power. And so far, it's done a really good job with that. I've had a tablet and a phone charging at the same time, and it knows to deliver, you know, the 2 amps of power to the tablet and the 500 milliamps of power to the phone, and it does both very well.
My guest is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Got a question about one of your technological devices, your iPad, computer, smartphone, Android, you name it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and post your question or comment there. What I thought was interesting is when it's plugged in, the power bag will charge all the connected devices first and then charge its own battery.
That's right. The bag itself on the outside of the bag has a power port that you plug straight into the wall, just like you would anything else. And as long as you have it turned on, it will charge all the devices first and then charge the battery. And I've been on a couple of different, you know, overnight trips with with a power bag that I have already, and, you know, plug my tablet and my phone in and, you know, plug the power bag into the wall. First of all, you know, it only uses the one outlet, you know, which is nice. But then it does, you know, when I woke up in the morning, everything was fully charged.
Now, you saw this at the International Consumer Electronics Show?
I did, yes.
What kind of interest was there in this sort of a thing?
There's a lot. A lot of people, especially with, you know, the current range of Android phones that are coming out with Verizon Wireless 4G LTE, and then Sprint and AT&T are doing the same thing, and the iPhone 4S. You know, all of these different devices come back with that same core issue, in that most people struggle to go an entire day without, you know, curbing their use somehow to get that full day worth of battery life. Mm-hmm. There are a couple of devices that are outliers, and, you know, people who, you know, maybe don't use their phone as much as others can get a whole day. But a lot of people, you know, have trouble getting that full, you know, 12 hours out of a phone.
Alan in Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thank you for taking my call, Ed.
You're welcome.
I have a quick question for your guest. I recently bought one of those wireless chargers for my iPhone. I was wondering if those work very well, because mine, personally, I don't get very good charges with it.
Inductive chargers are hit or miss depending on who the manufacturer is and whether or not that manufacturer is part of what's called the Wireless Power Alliance, so that they follow a specific standard for, you know, charging the individual devices. Which one do you have?
I have no idea. I got it as a Christmas gift.
Well, so it didn't say, like, Energizer or anything on it?
I mean, I just don't remember. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. It's fine. So a lot of these, you know, in order to have a really solid charge, the ones... a lot of these require, you know, very specifically setting it on, you know, the you know, dead center of the device so that it's receiving the full amount of power. The way inductive charging works, you know, it has what's almost a magnetic connection between the plate and the device. And the stronger that magnetic connection is, the faster the phone will charge.
Okay. Do you have a recommendation for one I could go get?
Energizer right now makes one that works for the largest variety of devices. And what they do for almost every phone is it's just a sleeve that you set your phone in. And what I like about the Energizer one is it has a big logo on the center of the pad. And if you just set it on that logo, you get a good charge.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Alan. What about Well, first of all, the power bag, it comes in lots of different styles. It's not just a backpack. You can get different, like, you can get it in a briefcase style.
You can get it in a briefcase or a messenger bag. There's a lot of different styles that you have. My personal favorite right now is actually the sling bag. It's actually one strap that goes over the shoulder and has a very backpack-like design, but you know, doesn't take up both shoulders.
What about something for a purse?
Well, the closest they have is what they call the tablet messenger, which mm-hmm. is a little bit bigger than what most purses are. Mm-hmm. It's basically designed to hold an iPad, so it's going to be right around the same size as an iPad. Mm-hmm. But it's definitely that compact feel, and then has, you know, the same size battery in it, so it would work as both a purse and, you know, a tablet or phone charger.
And what are we talking about in the cost department?
The cheapest that I've seen, the messenger bag, is right around $100, and I've yet to see anything but the briefcases go above $200. And what you have to understand is that a lot of these batteries, if you buy them separately, the batteries themselves can often be almost $100.
So they're just thrown in the container.
Right, and a lot of these are very nice bags. The two bags that I've actually tested myself have been very high-quality bags that can hold quite a bit of weight.
Bob in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thanks very much. My wife and I are both considering and getting close to buying the Apple iPhone 4S. I think that's not 4G capable yet. Is that correct?
That is correct. It's a 3G phone.
Is it going to be migrating to that? Is it worth us holding off a little bit until that happens? I guess I'm wondering what your assessment is of the whole 4G.
Well, the 4G networks are definitely a great deal faster. You absolutely see a performance difference when you do things like use a web browser. I personally prefer a 4G phone over a 3G phone. The issue that there's a lot of speculation as to whether or not Apple's going to include one 4G service or another in the next version of their iPhone, because Apple has a very specific hardware profile that they like to keep. They want them to be thin, and they want them to be a specific battery size. And so as long as the technology is there to allow Apple to keep that very thin, very nice form factor, then there will absolutely be, a 4G version of the next iPhone. But unless that happens, we probably won't see it.
Okay. Thanks very much.
No problem.
Okay. You wanted to talk about the Droid RAXR Max?
Razer Max.
What the heck? I don't know what she wrote here. Tell
this
us.
This is an evolution of the original Motorola Razer from from a couple of years ago. This is actually a smartphone version of the Razer. And what Motorola did was, they took the smartphone and they made it as thin as possible originally. And they made a very thin phone, and it was a great design. But like we were talking about earlier, it didn't really have particularly good battery life. And unlike most Android phones, you couldn't actually replace the battery in the Droid Razer. It was built in like an iPhone, and you couldn't remove it or replace it or get a bigger one. A lot of people complained about that. And so rather than make a removable battery cover, what Motorola did was they turned around and made the Droid Razer Max. It has almost the exact same shape, almost the exact same thickness as a Droid Razer, but it has almost twice the battery in it.
Hmm.
And I was very impressed with how long you could keep this phone going. I actually was able to use this phone the same way I use any other phone for a little over a day and a half.
Oh.
And I mean, like, I went to sleep and I woke up the next morning and still hadn't put it on the charger. The phone got me, I think, 1 day and 16 hours. And that was just normal use. I would love to see battery this size in almost every phone, because a phone, I think, particularly these devices that are starting to be more like small computers, they should really last longer than 8 hours.
Well, speaking of size, what size does it add to the phone? How does it enlarge the phone?
Well, actually, at its finished point, The Droid Razer Max is actually still, I think it's 8.9 millimeters. And that was the original Droid Razer was actually 1.9 millimeters thinner than that. So it's really not a noticeable difference for anybody. I mean, you can hold the two phones in your hand and see that there's a difference, but otherwise you're not going to see a difference in the phone. And the phone is still just as thin as an iPhone 4 or a Samsung Galaxy Nexus. They're very, very thin phones.
But it's a little heavier.
It's a little tiny bit heavier. It's definitely one of the cool things that Motorola did with this is make it so that it really was not that noticeable. I mean, even at its heaviest, the Droid Razer Max is only 5 ounces.
Now it's not cheap. Nothing is it?
Well, I mean, like any smartphone on Verizon Wireless right now, any LTE smartphone on Verizon Wireless, it's $299 on a new contract.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the blanket price that Verizon has for all of the new phones that they have that have the 4G LTE service in them. It's going to be that price range. It's going to be $299 with a new contract.
Okay. We have an email from Chris, wants to change subjects. They apologize, but they say they need help. Chris writes, sorry, this is not on topic, but I need to upgrade my D-Link DLG 4500. I am stuck trying to decide between the Linksys E3200 at 109 and a refurbed E4200 at 100, and which would be give the best performance for use with two wired Xbox 360s and a wired PS3. Holy Toledo, Chris. Two of the three. I am going to admit, I have no idea what Chris is talking about. Do you, Russell, know what he's talking about?
I do. And, okay. And the D-Link DLG is a hard act to follow. The device was built specifically for the use case that he has there in that, you know, connecting multiple devices that need a lot of really intense bandwidth for moving things around. You know, the Linksys routers, you know, they're powered by, you know, some of Cisco's software, so that they've got some, not all, but some of the enterprise level, you know, software in there that helps, you know, route things intelligently, and that may be the best way to go for what you're doing. But I would be curious as to a little more information about, you know, what specific problems you were having with the with this, you know, really crazy, you know, D-Link router that you've got, because those
why
were...
he needs to upgrade in the first place.
Well, you know, a lot of people, specifically with the D-Link router, there was a software issue that made it difficult to go back, and D-Link had some issues with that. So I have seen a lot of people who are trying to get away from that particular model, but that's a pretty serious piece of hardware. That's definitely not something that, you know, the average person would be picking up at Best Buy. But to answer your question, I think Linksys would probably be the best way to go if you're looking to replace your D-Link.
Okay. We just have a few minutes left, but you did want to chat a little bit about 3D TVs. And I was wondering, you're asking the question about whether or not they're really, the home consumer is really ready for them.
I catch a lot of mixed opinions when it comes to 3D TVs, because there are people who have that home entertainment center in their house. And I don't just mean, you know, the TV in the living room where everyone gets together to watch, you know, 30 Rock. I mean, they have, a small theater set up in their house where nothing else goes on in that room. It's, you know, they're a step away from having, you know, theater seats in that room. And that kind of person, you know, really has a desire for the 3D TV and the 3D glasses and do these things. I find it really difficult to sympathize with that person, because I'm almost, you know, the rarity that I am in the living room sitting at my TV watching something live and not just something that I've recorded on TiVo or something, I almost always have a phone in my hand or my laptop or a tablet, and those are not 3D devices. So here I sit with these silly 3D glasses on my face, and, you know, I'm watching this show in 3D, and I go to look down at my phone or my tablet or my laptop.
No can
and
do.
None of these things are in 3D, so right. they look funny. And yep. I almost think that there are more people, you know, not nearly so technically engaged as I am, but people who, you know, they sit and they watch TV, and they do have a, you know, a laptop or a phone or a tablet.
Gotta let it go.
Right.
Russell Holly, thanks so much again.
All right, thank you.
Russell Holly, tech blogger for geek.com. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. Streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support for 89.7 comes from COSI, presenting Race, Are We So Different? This exhibit looks at the science and history of race in America with photography, artifacts, and hands-on activities. It's an exhibit for the whole family. More information at COSI.org.